and his life becoming a surgeon. It is a story of struggle, loss, danger, courage, and love. Again, that's a film screening of Undocumented, Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. This is Per Fograng, and the show is Fight the Empire. And our guest, I believe we have him on the line, is Joe Loria, who's a veteran journalist, and he's now the editor of Consortium News. So, Joe Loria, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, you know, the Russian meddling melodrama continues. And I don't know, I like to keep reminding people of two things that get ignored. One is that William Binney, who was an NSA person for 30 years, he says that this was a leak, not a hack, and is based on the time it took to download all this DNC information. So it was a leak, not a hack, but this story is ignored. It's never rebutted. It's never mentioned. The other thing is that the DNC material, as far as I know, it was all true stuff. It was like Hillary Clinton's speeches to Wall Street guys. It was the Democratic National Committee, how they messed up with Bernie Sanders' campaign. And this is true information, not lies, stuff that people had a right to know. So we should keep that in mind, and that leaves this whole social media war. So, Joe Loria, where are we in the social media war?
Well, there's so much here to talk about. The Bill Binney angle, social media, as you just said, the indictments recently from Mueller of 12 GRU, a military intelligence agents in Russia. But I think we've moved, just speaking generally, we've moved into a new phase of Russiagate. This began more than 2 years ago, right after the DNC announced that they had been hacked. They immediately blamed Russia. And it's been going on since then. I wrote a piece in the Huffington Post actually 3 days before the November election in 2016, in which I predicted, correctly it turned out, that if Clinton should lose, and I didn't believe she would lose at that point, like most people, but if she should lose, they would blame this on Russia and try to get the election overturned in the Electoral College, which they did try to do, but it failed. And then in the Senate, when the Senate certifies the election, which they tried but also failed. But they've not let go of the narrative that Russia was responsible for electing Donald Trump. And that is a big stretch, even if you were to believe that these hacks were done by Russia, by the GRU agents, which we cannot be certain of, because what Mueller has produced is an indictment. An indictment has no evidence. It is not evidence in itself, and yet it's being reported on as a conviction, as the result of evidence having been produced. And that's the way the media reports it, and everyone is taking this who believes in Russiagate. In fact, I argue in one of the pieces I wrote this last month in Consortium News that we will never see the evidence behind this Mueller indictment for the simple reason that these 12 GRU agents will never be arrested by Russia and can't even be extradited to the U.S. because there's no extradition treaty. And even if they sent lawyers to the courtroom in Washington to challenge this indictment without any arrests being made, the prosecutors, the U.S. prosecutors, will not reveal this evidence in court. They will claim it's national security. It's clearly based on some intelligence, if at all. And that intelligence cannot be looked at in open court. They will invoke state secrets privilege and show this supposed evidence to a judge who has clearance in his chambers, and he could actually pronounce a judgment even if there's a civilian jury there. So we will never see the evidence. That's happened, by the way, in the Chelsea Manning case, in Sybil Edmonds cases, these two whistleblowers. So we'll never see the evidence. But that doesn't seem to be important in this story.
Well, in one of your articles, you mentioned another case where lawyers did, claim discovery, and a judge kind of ruled in their favor, and then the prosecutors appealed it. Now, has that story played out yet?
No, that's the earlier indictments from Robert Mueller of the so-called Internet Research Company in St. Petersburg, which spent about $100,000 on Facebook ads. This has got a lot of media attention, of course, so I think your listeners know what I'm talking about. The supposed ads and events that were set up, they were pro-Clinton and pro-Trump, both of them. They were playing both sides. There's a good argument that this was a commercial operation only. It was certainly a private company without any established links to the Kremlin. They were trying to make money, it looks like. But even if they were trying to help Trump, can $100,000 in Facebook ads stack up against hundreds of millions of dollars spent by the Clinton campaign? Of course not. So what happened was, in that case, this Internet Research Company sent lawyers to the courtroom, or to a judge in Washington here where I am, and to challenge this and want discovery to be able to see what the evidence is. And this surprised Mueller and his team, and they had to scramble and put together a motion to deny this opportunity, this hearing where this evidence would supposedly have to be produced, and the judge rejected that motion. So now it's up to Mueller to come up with this evidence. And what he's doing is compiling the evidence and going to make arguments, like I had mentioned before, saying, well, this is classified, so we can't produce it. We'll have to show it to the judge in court. So that's where we are right now. He's going through the evidence, supposedly, to see what he can or cannot produce. Now, you mentioned Bill Binney. And Bill Binney, yes, did this study where he set up a server in New Jersey, and he has some hacker friends, he told me, in Amsterdam and in London, and he twice tried to have the hackers in Europe hack this computer in New Jersey, set up for this experiment to see how fast they could transfer the data, and it can't be done. According to the download information on the metadata that comes from Guccifer 2.0, whoever Guccifer 2.0 is, and this is key to this hacking story, the identity of Guccifer 2.0. So this speeds that, at least if this metadata is accurate, it would show that it had the speed with which the files were transferred had to have been done locally on a download to a thumb drive or to an external hard drive from the servers or a DNC computer. Could not have been a hack. This is the argument Bill Binney is making. And there's a new article by Duncan Campbell in Computer Weekly which tries to destroy Bill's argument. Bill is pushing back on that. He says he's misrepresented in the article, that he didn't change his mind. Readers should read that article, but what's wrong with that article is that it also takes as a conviction and as proof an indictment by Mueller that the Russians had done this. We still, after all this time, have no solid proof of who may have hacked, if it was indeed a hack, the DNC computers. And of course, the day after the DNC spoke about a month after Julian Assange said on British television that he had Clinton emails that he was going to come out with. Then the DNC said the Russians hacked us. And then 2 days later, this private company, CrowdStrike, with ties to the Atlantic Council, this anti-Russian Atlantic Council, announced that they had examined the servers, and it was Russia. Why? Because they found Cyrillic letters and the name of the first Soviet intelligence chief in there. This was supposed to have been a sophisticated operation, and yet they left these amateur clues. The key here is the DNC did not allow the FBI to look at their computer. And that is a question that has never really been answered, even though James Comey, the FBI director at the time, was asked, and he said, yeah, well, we really should have looked at it ourselves, and normally we would, but we had this great private company. So they're relying on a paid company paid for by the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton campaign to do a private study rather than a public investigation by the FBI to tell us that Russia did it. These are the kinds of questions that one has to raise. And for me, the bedrock of journalism is skepticism. Mm-hmm. This is what Bob Perry stuck with. This is what I'm trying to stick with at Consortium News. And it's to say, until you show us the evidence, we do not have to accept this, and we need to question it, leaving the door open that it could be true. Russia could have hacked this, but we don't have that evidence yet, and it will never come out in court, as I just argued. And as you said earlier at the beginning, even if the Russians did it, they, in a sense, provided a service to American voters by letting us see what really was happening inside the DNC, how they cheated Bernie Sanders out of this nomination from way back. In the beginning, they were doing what they could to stop him. And other means of corruption, collusion with the press, letting New York Times reporters send their stories to the DNC for approval before publication, something absolutely forbidden in this profession of journalism, to allow your sources to vet an article before you publish it. And we saw all manner of things. We even had in one of the emails, and I wrote a book on the emails called How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. It's kind of a tongue-in-cheek title, but it's based on the words of Clinton and her associates in these emails. And Julian Assange wrote the foreword, and I did an analysis of the emails, a critical analysis. And there's one email which says that they were debating back and forth, the DNC and the Clinton campaign, whether to accept money from a foreign source, which is purely illegal. And in the end, one of the top offices in her campaign said, yeah, let's take it. Now, I don't know if they did in the end, but these are the kinds of things that were revealed. Now, Assange was loved by the Democrats when he revealed crimes by the Bush administration in Afghanistan and Iraq. This put WikiLeaks on the map. The Liberal Guardian in Britain and the New York Times published and worked with WikiLeaks to publish these findings. It made the Republican administration look bad. So then he was a hero of the Democrats. In this case, he received these emails of the DNC and later the Podesta emails, the campaign chairman of the Clinton campaign. What was he supposed to do? Just sit on these emails, not publish them? Why? Because he didn't get Republican emails? Well, he sits back and waits what he gets, usually from whistleblowers. And he got these emails. He tried to get Republican emails. In fact, he did get some Trump emails, and they started to analyze them. And this is explained in an article we just published by Stefania Morizzi, an Italian journalist from La Repubblica, who worked with Assange and WikiLeaks team, because he partnered with several major newspapers around the world, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, and La Repubblica. And she says that they got some Trump emails or RNC emails, and as they were analyzing, they discovered they had already been made public before. Now, Trump was kind of an open book anyway. Mm-hmm. He let us know he was a misogynist, a racist, or at least he was using racism, that he wanted torture to come back again. He said so in debates. He was an open book. Clinton was hiding her positions and pretending to be something other than she was, and these emails helped the public understand who she was. So it was a service. No one has ever doubted the accuracy of the emails that WikiLeaks produced. That's what this whole Russia thing's about, because even if Russia did do it,
we should thank
them.
The
emails are true. Mm-hmm. The emails are true, and they're trying to divert attention from the content of the emails, which helps explain why she lost, because she was a lousy candidate, close to Wall Street, didn't care at all about the working class. Trump also didn't care about the working class, but he was a better liar than she was, I think, mm-hmm. and making people believe that he was going to help them. So now Binney believes that Guccifer 2.0 was an American construct, probably by the CIA. He has no direct evidence of that, but he thinks in this spirit of having the distraction from the content of the emails and blaming Russia, that they created after the fact, after this leak that was sent to WikiLeaks, they created a so-called Russian GRU operation to hack these emails, and they created this guy 2.0, who says he was a Romanian hacker. Now, I have no idea whether that's true either, but the fact is we don't know. And to go on the air and in print every day, louder and louder, saying Russia did this, attacked our democracy, it's 9/11, it's Pearl Harbor rolled into one, building tensions with nuclear-armed Russia, despising Trump for going to try to have better relations with Russia, which is the only, along with North Korea, the only two positions that I support of Trump's. I hate everything else he's doing. But those are the ones that really they can't stand, because they want bad relations with Russia, which goes into their whole geopolitical strategy to go back to the 1990s when they had a puppet Yeltsin in power and they were able to basically run Russia and asset strip the country in league with local oligarchs to impoverish the people of Russia but enrich themselves on Wall Street. And Putin came along and put an end to that, and they want to get rid of Putin. That's, I think the record bears that out. And so ramping up tensions with Russia is important, but also trying to explain away Hillary Clinton's loss. And to set themselves up now also, by the way, for the next election. They're already telling us the Russians are hacking it. So if the Democrats lose, they've got a built-in excuse right away. It was Russia. They will never lose an election again for you, fair and square. And in fact, as Greg Powell and others have shown, the Republicans using cross-check and caging and all these other tricks get mostly black Democratic voters off the rolls in Michigan and Wisconsin and everything, as they had done all the way back in 2000 in Florida in the general election. This is where the election may have been stolen, and probably was stolen for the Republicans, not by Russia. You know, but the Democrats don't want to talk about those.
Well, this thing about hacking the election machines, I remember back was 2000, 2004, Harvey Wasserman and Bob Fitrakis were talking about this, and they're saying that the secretaries of states, you know, who were Republicans, were kind of letting this happen.
Absolutely correct. Yet we hear nothing about that. We hear only about Russia, Russia, Russia. And if Russia hacked it, they gave us accurate information about Clinton anyway.
You know, it's sort of an air of desperation about this. You know, they keep repeating this, and I just wonder what accounts for the desperation. I've got one theory. You know, that during the 1990s, when the West was kind of looting Russia, was kind of raping Russia, and they sort of thought of it as loving Russia to death, I guess. So it's a kind of a coitus interruptus thing. They really got to finish the job. But that's, maybe I'm being kind of loose here. But
I agree. That's what they're doing. The overall geopolitical strategy, I think, is to finish the get back into Russia. But in the short term, what they're reacting to, in my opinion, is the insurgencies on the right and the left in the 2016 American election, what happened in France with Marine Le Pen, what's going on in Germany. There is a popular revolt. Unfortunately, the right wing, not the left wing insurgency, is getting the upper hand. They elected Trump, not Sanders, for example. Mm-hmm. So, but the establishment is very worried because, as Chris Hedges really well points out and explains extremely well, the 30-year experiment of neoliberal politics, going back to Reagan and Thatcher, has played its the toll is now coming to fruit to bear here. We are now seeing the results of 30 years of raping the working and middle classes to enrich people at the top through a various series of policies, mostly to get government out of private sector, privatization, cutting back on social welfare programs, etc. And this has been all over the world. So this now is failing. After 30 years, people are fed up. They don't believe their leaders. They don't, by the way, think Russia is an important issue. In the last Gallup poll from last week, which had statistical insignificance, in a poll asked, what are your main concerns? Russia was so low on the list, it didn't even register 1%. So they're reacting. They're desperate. Now, the neocons have had a policy. The political policy of the neocons has been through war to overthrow governments that's standing in the way of U.S. interests abroad. And we see immediately results of disaster in Libya, in Iraq, in Syria, where the neoliberal position, which is economic policy that both Democratic and Republican administrations have implemented since Reagan, has taken 30 years to show its disaster on society, on our own societies, not on Middle East societies, which is instant almost. But here we see the failure of these policies, and there's a rebellion going on right now, and they're losing control. And as Hedges points out, they don't have a counter argument anymore. So they're resorting to more harsh means like censorship and this Russia campaign to try to divert attention from their own failings and blame it on Russia as a scapegoat for what is going wrong in their societies. They cannot gain control. Now, there are people even blaming the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, which is small but growing and putting pressure on the establishment Democrats. They're saying they are now stooges of Russia. You know, Jill Stein was a stooge of Russia because she went to a dinner in Moscow and Putin briefly sat at her table. Now, here's the best example I know of the desperation of this Russiagate crowd. In the indictment, it said that on July 16, 2016, at 10:30 a.m., Donald Trump stood up and said, Russia, if you're listening, hack those, get those 30,000 emails from Clinton's private server, not the DNC server, but her private server. And that apparently that day, it says in the indictment, there was an attempt made to spearfish a private server in Clinton's office. So it doesn't directly say that those two events were linked, but the implication is there. So the New York Times and others ran stories the next day saying, was Russia listening when Trump said hack the DNC, the private server of Clinton? Now, this is absurd on its face. If this were a covert intelligence operation, A, there's no evident need for Russia to have help from anyone on the Trump campaign in terms of collusion. And B, would Trump have initiated a covert operation on national and even worldwide TV by giving off a signal like that? And on top of that, that Clinton server was in the possession at that moment of the Department of Justice. A year before, sometime in 2015, in the fall, Clinton had turned over her server, her private server, to the DOJ. So it was offline when it was being investigated. It couldn't have been hacked anyway. But that shows you the desperation to try to prove collusion, that somehow not only did Russia get these emails and published them to turn the election to Trump, but that they worked with some people on the Trump campaign to do it. This is what is not in this last indictment, and which is core to this entire Russiagate story. There's a whole book by Luke Harding, called Collusion. There's no evidence of collusion. They're desperate to produce it, and I predict that this Marina Butina, this 29-year-old Russian woman who's been arrested and only charged so far with not registering as a foreign agent, and her crime really laid out in this affidavit, is... It starts with a long political rant against Russia, and then it says she was trying to improve relations between the U.S. and Russia, trying to improve relations. And she met with various Americans from Political Party One, which is clearly the Republicans. So they're setting this up, that this woman was the link between Russia and Trump campaign people. And only thing they talked about was improving relations between the two countries, which is imperative if we want to avoid conflict between nuclear superpowers.
Is that something that people are not allowed to do? I mean, if I went to Russia or something like that and talked to people about improving relations, I mean, what makes it illegal?
That's where we're headed. It's not illegal now, but we're headed now. You're being ostracized and condemned and called a Putin puppet and a stooge of the Kremlin and a Russian agent, and I've been called that, and Consortium News has been called that by people in public on Facebook and emails I get on other statements. So and we're not the only ones. There was that Proper Not organization run by some anonymous group that published their report, and it was splashed on the front page of the Washington Post in November of 2015. On Thanksgiving holiday, this listed 30 or 100 or something websites that were Russian controlled, and Consortium News was one of them. Truthdig, Counterpunch, a whole bunch of them, the alternative media, all of it was smeared as Russian agents. Why? Because we have critical view of American foreign policy going back, going back to the Cold War. I started criticizing in print and in speech American foreign policy in the 80s. That's well before RT ever existed, before the Russian Federation. So we're supposed to believe that the reason I go on RT, I go on Sputnik Radio to be interviewed, the reason that I'm saying these things is because I'm getting talking points from the Kremlin. No, it's the other way around. The reason the Russians are inviting me to speak is because they had read my articles at Consortium and they knew what my positions were. So they wanted me to talk because that's the only platform we can get any critics. So it blocks criticism of their foreign policy by smearing it as Russian propaganda. They're in trouble, the ruling circles here, the establishment, from these insurgencies in Europe and here and in the U.S. They're losing grip. And wealthy and rich people are always looking over their shoulder who's going to take their money and power away from them. They're always paranoid, maybe because they're guilty about how they gained this wealth and power. But they're always worried about this. So the moment they see some kind of stirring, I mean, Consortium News is just a little spark in the middle of this country. It's nothing. But, you know, they want to crush small alternative websites like ours because it could turn into something. It could rile people up. It keeps alive an alternative viewpoint and a critical viewpoint of these people who want to keep their power and their lifestyles. This is what it comes down to. They're in charge, and the rest of us are supposed to do what they tell us to do.
Well,
this is the society we live in, and we don't want anybody criticizing us.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty old, goes back to the beginning of civilization, to keep people ignorant and to stop them from speaking out against corrupt rulers.
Well, where can people go to get the news from Consortium?
Consortiumnews.com.
Consortiumnews.com. Uh-huh.
That's correct.
You know, we've got a couple minutes left. There's an interesting event here, a take on the Skripal case, the so-called nerve agent poisoning.
Yep.
Apparently, Yulia talked to her cousin Victoria and says that that she's going to be coming back to Russia, and as soon as her father Sergei is able to do that. Now, they've been been kept sequestered by the British government, and the British government put out what they call a D notice to all the media, kind of telling them to be quiet about the whole thing. But now, apparently, something is happening there.
Well, if the Brits let her go, I think they're in seclusion. They're being hidden. They're being suppressed. They don't want, I think, these people to speak out about what happened.
Mm-hmm.
They were supposed to have been attacked by the most dangerous substance on Earth, and they survived. How did that happen?
I don't know.
Why did they? If they tried to kill this young woman, why did she? Russians try to kill her. Why did she want to go to Russia? They'll have a much easier chance to get her there than they would in the UK. So they're trying to protect her from Russian attack, and yet she wants to return to Russia. I don't think they're going to let her go. It's going to be a big battle. They won't let her speak to Russian consular officials.
Well, apparently somehow she contacted her cousin. So
her cousin, yeah.
And then
Seymour
Hersh just came out, said that if this had really been a nerve agent, half the town would have been dead or something like that.
Yeah. The whole thing is so iffy and so suspicious. I don't know what really happened there. But to immediately blame Russia without giving Russia any evidence, without working with them to see how this happened, you know, this is, why won't you just show them the evidence if you have it and let Russia respond to it? No. They are guilty in the court of public opinion immediately, and the British press is as bad or worse than ours here in the U.S., and they ran with that story and tried to jam it down people's throats. But as I pointed out earlier, at least here in the U.S., Russia, people don't give a damn about Russia in the U.S. They care about health insurance. They care about keeping their jobs and not losing their homes and not being evicted from their apartments as the middle class continuously is being devastated by these neoliberal policies that are failing now and are becoming obvious that they were failures. And the rulers who implemented these neoliberal policies are scared. They're threatened by the population. They've got to be contained, and you can't have media like ours getting more influential. So they've got to stop it and smear us as Russian agents. This is the strategy.
But you keep hearing that the economy is going great.
Yeah, for the people on in the 1%, sure.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it counts. They are America. We are in America. It's, when they talk about national interests, it's their interests. National security, it's their security that they're talking about, not ours. They can give a damn about us.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that obvious?
Well, it is to a lot of people, but apparently not to NPR. But anyway, I think it's time to kind of wrap this up. We've been talking with Joe Loria, who is the editor of Consortium News, and I really recommend it. Just go to Consortium News on the Internet, and there's all kinds of great articles there. I guess every day there's something new, so I recommend that, and I recommend helping out Consortium News. They don't get money from the corporations, I'll tell you that. So anyway, Joe Loria, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for your time. Bye-bye.
And stay tuned to KBOO. It's your radio station, folks. It's our radio station as long as we can keep it on the air. So stay tuned for something. I think Air Cascadia comes. Oh, Flashpoints comes up next. So Flashpoints is one of the best shows around.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African high life. Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
Coming up the rest of this morning on KBOO at 11 on Between the Covers, Lisa Loving welcomes back Gregory Pardlow to talk about his new book, Air Traffic. At 11:30, Black Book Talk welcomes librarian Patricia Hurd Hobson to discuss the best books they've ever read. But next, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you want to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
Today on Flashpoint.